This is the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast. I'm your host this week, Ann Nicholson Weber, and my guests are three artists involved in the production of Shining City by Connor McPherson, currently being produced by Irish Theater of Chicago at the Den. Irish Theater of Chicago was formerly known as Shaughnessy Theater. So Coburn Goss and Brad Armacost are two of the cast members, and Jeff Christian directed the show. Let's just dive in. So, Jeff, if you could just set up very, very briefly, you know, what the play is.
So it all takes place in a therapist's office in Dublin. There's this therapist named Ian. He's a former priest, and he's taken on this job as a therapist. His main patient that we see during the play is a fellow named John, played by Brad, who is recently bereaved and has now seen his dead wife.
Well, let's just start with one of the things I noticed that seemed very distinctive to me about the style, and not what I remember from other Connor McPherson pieces, which is the kind of stuttery quality of the dialogue. So both of the characters played by Brad and by Kobe are hardly ever finish a sentence, interrupt themselves, leave things unsaid, kind of change directions mid-sentence. And it struck me as it might have been a challenging style to play.
Kobe?
Absolutely.
Talking over one another.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know,
we're not letting each other finish anything. No, it was extremely difficult to learn these lines. I can say that without any hesitation.
Yeah.
It is, I believe it was Ben Brantley who said in his review of the New York production that McPherson has taken his characters out of the comfortable narrative of the monologue, which is indeed he's a master of, and thrust them into conversations, many of which end, you know, I mean, and it's like reading a score with just many, many grace notes in it to
yes.
hear all of those unfinished sentences.
So what do you think he's doing with those kind of staccato rhythms? What is the effect on you as an actor to speak that way? And what do you think might be the effect on that he intends us to have?
I think his intention is to obviously to show natural dialogue, the way people speak, but also the main characters, John and Ian, are, for all intents and purposes, strangers. So these are not men who have a history. They're not necessarily comfortable with each other, especially outside of the confines of patient and therapist. So I think he's going for that, and he achieves it very well.
Mm-hmm.
As an actor, like I said before, it can be very difficult to memorize. And if you're not on your game the entire time, you can easily go to another
page.
Place. Yes.
Would you guys be willing to just demonstrate a little bit of what this dialogue sounds like? You're welcome to say no.
Well, that section in five.
Maybe when I come out of the bathroom the last time?
Sure.
This is scene five. So, God, how you keeping?
I'm good, you know. Hanging in there, you know. I bought an apartment.
Oh, wow. So we're both?
Yeah. Moving. We're both moving. Yeah. Nearly done with the legal, which can be a nightmare.
Yeah,
so.
Well, if it's what you got to do, I know it's right.
Yeah. It's lovely, you know. It's down there on the seafront, there near St. Anne's Park.
Oh, very nice. Yeah, I know there.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know.
Very nice.
Yeah, so it's a whole new...
And you're good? In yourself, and
I'm good. Yeah. I'm looking forward to the move. You know, I've actually been in the house this last month.
Right, yeah. God. Do you take sugar?
No, I don't.
Oh, good, because I don't.
Well, I don't anyway. So
great, thank you. So you can hear, that the listeners can get an idea for how this dialogue just pops back and forth, kind of, and a lot of ideas don't get finished.
There are times when it's like two individual conversations are going on.
They're not actually connected.
They're not. Yes. In many ways, they'll be, one will end and another will go off literally a different train of thought.
I mean, the thing that to me gets under my skin about this play is just the way it evokes loneliness. This, just people who are so lost and alone without any support. And it does it so beautifully. So I was wondering if you felt that the way it's written, is about that. And I think what you just said is yes, that the way they're having these, they're not connecting and they're having these two different conversations some of the time. Well, the other thing that's to me very interesting about the way it's written is that, Kobe as Ian says very little because he's in the role of the therapist for big, big chunks of the play, just listening. Mm-hmm. And Brad as John has the big bravura part, I would say. But if I had to say which is the main character, I might say Ian.
Right.
Oh, he's who's on the stage the entire time.
Absolutely.
And who is just maybe starting or certainly has not finished his journey
right.
at the end of the play, but has been perhaps the most affected by
right.
what's gone on. So that's an interesting structure. What's it like, Kobe, to play a part that's a main part, you're on the stage the whole time, but most of the time you're listening?
It's funny. Having to listen to this extent on stage does require quite a bit of concentration,
yeah.
as you would imagine. But I think because it's so well written, because McPherson has given such a rich backstory to this character, as a priest, as someone who has always found himself in service of other people, that it just seems natural that he would sit and let another person speak for such a long period of time. And I think because he allows John to go on and on, especially in scene three, it shows how good of a therapist he really is.
Mm-hmm. Does McPherson write every now and then you would go, mm-hmm, or just some little affirming
noise? That's all
McPherson.
That's
written, right?
That's
yeah.
all McPherson.
It's true that you think, wow, this is an impressive example of the therapeutic relationship, because mm-hmm. John is allowed to go someplace really scary and gets there and comes back. So that's good. Well, so Jeff, talking about the project of directing this play, was there anything that you did differently than you usually might in the rehearsal process? Was anything about the process that was, you can say
well,
no.
Well, I mean, the way we wanted to set it up, and we knew we wanted to make it very intimate. So we took a small theater space mm-hmm. and basically cut it in half. We
yes.
ran the diagonal of the wall of that office to make it so that it felt like the audience was participating in that therapy session
yeah.
as well.
I think that was a
challenge, I think, for the actors, because there's really no distance. So it kind of we kind of created a hybrid theater cinema acting style where small movements of the head were so much more important in this configuration than they would be on a normal stage production. So it was more like acting
uh-huh.
for the camera. But the upside of that too is they're not talking in stage voices. I mean, there are times in scenes where there are whispers, and they're not stage whispers. They're actually whispering, but we in the house can still hear them. So it feels hopefully, almost like we're intruding mm-hmm. in this, and it's voyeuristic. We almost shouldn't be watching this.
Yeah, we were talking, Jeff, before we started the recording, about I had seen a really excellent production at Goodman with John Judd and Jay Whitaker. But I do think that the size of that venue made it harder to have that kind of intimate connection with the play, with a small play, whereas this is kind of the opposite. I mean, it's a small play that's right in your face, magnified. You know, you see everything, as you said. It's a very wide space, and I wonder if that creates any challenges. It's wide and shallow mm-hmm. playing area. Does that create any particular challenges for any of the three of you in blocking, or...
Well, certainly it is shallow, it is wide, and we are reminded again and again when this is good and you'll take one step back, you know, you'll literally go a foot and that's bad. You know, uh-huh. it is very critical where your focus is. Jeff has a great cinematic eye and cannot sit in one seat while directing. He goes from chair to chair to chair to uh-huh. chair.
So I love finding ways to extend angles out and play the distance. So I working with the scenic designer Ira Amix, we talked about something that was shallow and wide, mm-hmm. so that we could get those long angles, yet still have it feel somewhat claustrophobic, and you know, Ian is not making a lot of money. He's starting this place out, so it's somewhat a dilapidated building that he was able to afford to set up shop. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things in the set too that speak to his character.
Like arched windows as an ex-priest. It's unavoidable to think about the confessional when you have a priest, ex-priest sitting there and a patient, you know, essentially confessing his sins, which is what ultimately happens. So I thought that was very effective, but I also thought it was really clear where we were. I mean, it was so institutional and kind of shabby institutional and,
a bad rehab job.
Yeah, right.
Taking an interesting space with arched windows and put in a lowered ceiling and can lights. It's a bad rehab job.
Yeah, and a buzzer that doesn't work, which creates some of the humor in the play. Well, Jeff, when you wanted to direct this show, did you start with did you for the first table reading or whatever, you got together with the cast and said, okay, we're going to do Shining City, and it's going to be about, this production is going to be about, is there anything like that in the way you start?
I think you have to start with that idea, and you're probably going to move off of it as you get into rehearsal. But it felt very much like a battle between who we are and who we want to be.
Mm. Well, so Brad, let's talk a little bit about the time when it stops being dialogue at all, and it is just Connor McPherson storytelling, because you relate at great length a pivotal event in your life and an extremely emotionally taxing one. Do you look skeptical, like you're not seeing that as storytelling?
Oh, no, I completely see that as storytelling.
Like, I mean, we talked before about The Weir, how that's mm-hmm. just a play of storytelling, and this is not at first, but during that key scene it is.
I'll go back to that statement of Brad. It's about it's there's something comfortable about a monologue mm-hmm. vis-a-vis The Weir or even Seafarer or Brian Friel in Faith Healer, any number of there's something comfortable in that and in control in the midst of that, which is not here in this one. This is very active and very, you're discovering moment by moment. So it doesn't really feel like you have a beginning, middle, and end to this story.
Well, that's really interesting you said that, because one of the things I noticed as you were doing that scene was that you knew the end of the story as the character, John knows where it goes. Mm-hmm. But as you told it, you didn't seem to. You were feeling the emotion, you were in the place, you were stuck in the place in the story that you were telling without in any way having it moderated or modulated by what you knew was coming next or the end.
Well, I think that's also to do, very much to do with a good therapist. Yeah. And Kobe is a good therapist.
Ian is a good therapist.
Well,
Kobe maybe too. So,
no, I'm very serious. When I looked at that, there were many times at rehearsals where I would just say to Jeff, send Kobe home. He doesn't, and Kobe wouldn't leave. Right. You know, it's like, he doesn't want to sit and listen to this for 45 minutes. I don't, but it's absolutely having that check-in. You're absolutely right. I don't know that this is, yes, I have an agenda, but I think it's probably, I was going to reveal to him that I went to a brothel. And that may be it. And yeah. That the affair and the resentment of his wife for not having children and the resentment of all people that do have children and who rub it into those that don't. I think those are all just, those are discoveries as they come up. And I think that's part of obviously good therapy. Mm-hmm. This is certainly not a comment on my mental health, but I've never had that experience. And we spent a good deal of time in rehearsals talking about what a therapy session would be like and what is the norms and how it works. But it's fascinating. And I appreciate, what you have just said about that because, that's a monologue is comfortable. This is not a monologue. It's a very, very active dialogue.
It's kind of like it's happening to you as you're telling it. That's the way I experienced it.
Right. And we talked a lot about this. This is a guy who's not, he doesn't share things with people.
Right.
He doesn't have those kind of relationships outside of it. So that helps, it helps to have things active on mm-hmm. stage and not just passive recounting of things that happened elsewhere. So he hasn't admitted this maybe even to himself.
Right.
So that keeps those emotions more raw.
Immediate.
and
mm-hmm.
forward moving and the discoveries being made and being kind of knocked off of a straight line.
Well, so you've obviously done it a lot of times. You didn't have previews, did you, or did you?
Well,
did you have previews?
Yeah. I guess it was one.
We had one preview.
One preview.
Yeah.
I'm doing Christmas Carol at the same time, so someone points me in a direction.
I have to call out that Brad is doing this interview after having done two performances of A Christmas Carol. He's going to do this incredibly taxing role. And you did a radio, what was it?
Unshackled, yes.
Yeah, right.
An hour-long radio.
That was his day-to-day. So
Jeez, Kobe, you're kind of a slacker.
I know. I went swimming today.
Well, so what I wanted to ask both of you is what was different about it in front of an audience?
Mm.
How about start with Kobe? Because I've been grilling Brad.
Well, I will say because of the intimate nature of this staging with what Jeff sort of brought out and was talking about earlier, I have found with an audience that very small gestures or even nods get a response from the audience. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And that's pretty satisfying too.
Yeah.
Especially when Brad's going on and on wow, they're actually listening to
they
me.
Know that I'm here.
Well, you probably shouldn't be waving your hands behind him while he's talking like that. I don't know.
And do you, when Brad is having some of these long flights, are you watching the audience? Do you let yourself leave the room enough to do that?
No.
So you didn't monitor except the way you would any time as an actor what the audience is feeling or responding.
Right. I mean, there might be, No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't.
So Brad, how about for you? What did the audience teach you that you didn't expect?
As always with Connor McPherson, there's more humor than is on the page. Or no, it's definitely on the page. It's just when you look at it, you think, well, that's there's no response there.
Right.
I can honestly say that and not in a precious way, that I just can't and don't in scene three, certainly the long scene, can't and don't monitor the audience, clock the audience at all. It's mm-hmm. just, it's really, there's one person in there, and it's, you know, I mean, it's my therapist, you know, it's, right. I didn't notice a bit of a difference.
Yeah.
Scenes one and scenes five, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I could just tell, oh my gosh, there's a response here.
Well, I would think that going back to what Jeff said about the almost cinematic acting, that calibrating that would be hard. I mean, that's a big dramatic scene. I mean, those are big emotions that you're feeling. And potentially, I don't know if you have to pull it in because the audience is so close and the space is so small. Do you have to rein it in the way you would for the camera or not?
Yes, I think you do. And I know Jeff.
Thinks you do.
And again, he just has a little fishing line move that he makes, like, pull it back. Uh-huh. Of course you do. Of course you do. And that's also the beauty of playing in a space like that.
Yeah.
Is just, you know, again, we're playing out at Drury Lane and there's 1,000 seats out there.
Right.
So you're
nothing is too big.
Nothing is too big.
Yeah.
Here, you know, we're just, you know, they're on the other couch in that
right.
room there.
Right. Well, here's one more, question about acting generally, which either of you can take, although obviously it comes from watching Brad's performance last night. When you have a scene like that, a really deeply emotional scene, I have to guess that you don't feel it every night, or at least not as deeply as you do when you're feeling inspired. Will you grant me that?
Yes.
Reluctantly, yeah. But...
Well, he's saying that sometimes Brad doesn't feel it. Talk about Brad.
So I'm really interested. I mean, I know that kind of the received wisdom, well, that's what technique is, and you recreate what you did when you did feel it. But I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that, which strikes me as a layperson, a pretty interesting...
Well, the first thing I would say, and Brad, I'm sure you'll agree, is that when the writing is good, it makes it easy.
Uh-huh.
Even if you're not having a good night, even if you're not feeling it. And good writing, such as this is, will help sort of channel those emotions. And through rehearsal, what we've done is we've put ourselves in a place where we understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we've done this enough that we can assimilate the appropriate emotion. But really, yeah, it's interesting with highly, you know, Brad should answer this too, but with highly emotional scenes, there might be two or three times in a run that you just feel on it.
Uh-huh.
And then you have to trust that those other nights are not, you're not shortchanging your audience.
Right. The difference in your performance is so much less than you
it
feel
feels
it to
huge
be.
To
right.
us.
Right.
But it's not, I don't think.
You're doing 90% of
right.
what you did
right.
when
well,
you felt.
And the other side of that is that sometimes that's not the most effective performance for the audience.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
yeah.
what the actor is feeling isn't always, that doesn't always transmit. And especially in this kind of configuration, it's tamping it down, fighting to control that emotion. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think hits
creates
people
a power.
Uh-huh. more.
Uh-huh.
Because mm-hmm. if you're doing it all for them, the audience doesn't need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But sometimes though, they, you know, they're, yeah, absolutely. You feel great and the audience responds, but that's not always the case. I mean, we know that, but it's just a weird, kind of a weird mindset for an actor.
Right.
It is indeed, and Kobe, you're exactly right, and I completely agree with it. The writing does the work. That
yeah.
skeleton is
yeah.
there, and just
yeah.
follow that. I would think that if you ever finish a performance, and I've done many, many Irish plays, and certainly Faith Healer, certainly The Weir, Seafarer. If you ever get to a point where you don't want one more crack at it, just give me one more crack at it, then it's really not that interesting anymore for you. There are times when you feel good, you know, I'm very flattered about, you know, that you mentioned last night's performance, which did not feel good to me. I mean, it was not, it was certainly of the four we've done, three we've done, it was certainly not my favorite, but the writing is there, the emotion is there, and, you know, I can't wait, as tired as I am, I can't wait for another crack at it today,
right.
I know when I finish tonight, I'll be just give me one more crack, and closing night, it's just going to be one more, and I still do that with Faith Healer, I do that with, you know, with...
You had a lot of cracks at Faith Healer.
That one kept coming back. doesn't happen.
It's still, I mean, that's the absolute joy of working on scripts like this.
Is it, when you have this kind of close proximity to the audience, does it mean that the personality of the audience has more effect on you in this kind of space than it would in a bigger space? Is there a clearer personality? Just there is with a small, you know, a small organization also has more culture and more personality than a big one. Is it like that with audiences?
I think if there's an audience, and this certainly isn't the first time that we've been in intimate spaces like this, but yes, if there are audiences who aren't willing to sort of experience it, not willing to be with us on the journey, that is felt.
Yeah, and then you have to work harder.
Right.
Or not. Not let yourself work
harder.
That's
the trick.
Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So I have one last question. This one is for Kobe, because I did find myself not sure where Ian was at the end. It's very clear that John is pretty well healed and on his way.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to spoil anything. I'll be careful.
Okay.
But do you see him as, having healed himself or not? Where is he in his journey?
I think there is still a good deal of repression with Ian. I think he thinks he's on the right path. In the last scene, you find out that he is moving to Limerick with his fiancée, Nasa, and their daughter. And he feels in that scene that it is the right thing to do.
In a conventional way, he's made the right choice. But yet, I was left very ambivalent about how to feel about that. And I think, again, with no spoilers, Connor McPherson gives us some reasons to be very skeptical.
Right. But that is what Ian indeed needs to be doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it's easy for Ian to tell someone else, mistakes that they're making, but it's incredibly difficult for him to follow that advice.
Unlike most of the rest of humanity,
right. Yeah,
finds it a lot easier to solve other people's problems. Thank you very much for joining me to talk about this. And Brad, special thanks to you, given what all else you did today. And have a great performance tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.